Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
I'm Jesse Thorne. A lot of the times great songwriters come in pairs. Rodgers and Hart, Ashford and Simpson, Isaac Hayes and David Porter. And now, add to the list Kristen Anderson Lopez and Robert Lopez. The two have written dozens of songs for movies and TV together. They've won award after award. That includes the music from Frozen, so if you're a parent, you can thank them for Let It Go. But writing songs for a movie like that isn't easy. I mean, take it from them. So much great material gets left on the cutting room floor.
One of the things we had to cut from that was, I hope that I don't vomit in his face. They were like, you can't say vomit. You just can't say vomit. It makes people vomit.
No, there was a girl in the story room who you could tell every time we mentioned it or talked about it, she just got sicker and sicker. She was turning green at the end of the song. And so we were like, come on. That's funny.
It's Bullseye. Coming up, a special Academy Awards edition of Bullseye. Kristen and Robert talk about their Oscar-nominated song for Disney's Coco. The two have been songwriters pretty much their entire lives. They've been married for almost 15 years, and they're parents, too, which doesn't always mix perfectly with being Academy Award-nominated songwriters.
It's funny because, they've always been mildly annoyed at our trips to go to awards shows and stuff like that. And this time, they've been incredibly supportive. And I think it has something to do with the fact that we're bringing them as our dates.
But first, great Laurie Metcalf. She's up for her first Academy Award for her supporting role in the wonderful Lady Bird. Growing up, she didn't really have her mind made up about becoming an actress. I mean, she liked theater and all, but it was impractical. You couldn't study something impractical in college.
But I will pursue the study of German, thinking, what? Oh, I'll be a translator somewhere. You know, where? There was no connecting of the dots anywhere.
That's all coming up on this year's Bullseye Oscars special. We just invented that. Let's go. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My first guest is Laurie Metcalf. Laurie's a veteran actor. In the late 70s, when she was in college, she and a few of her classmates started putting on plays at a Unitarian church in Deerfield, Illinois. Those classmates, by the way, included people like Gary Sinise, John Malkovich, and Tracy Letts. The theater, which they called Steppenwolf, became one of the most acclaimed companies in the United States. Maybe you were lucky enough to see Laurie in the off-Broadway rendition of Balm in Gilead back in the 80s. She won 1,000 awards for her part in it. You almost definitely saw her in another role, though, on Roseanne. For 9 years, she played Jackie, Roseanne's sister on the show. Laurie just got her first ever Academy Award nomination for her role in Lady Bird, the coming-of-age movie directed by Greta Gerwig. The movie centers around the title character, Lady Bird McPherson, a high school senior living in Sacramento, California. She's dreaming of getting out, moving to the East Coast, going wherever it is that writers live. Laurie plays Marion, Lady Bird's mom, and the relationship between the two of them is one of the most compelling things about the movie. In a way, it's the subject of the movie. It's complicated, it's messy, they fight a lot, they push each other's buttons, but they also really love and care for each other. Let's take a listen to a scene from Lady Bird. So a little background. This is towards the beginning of the movie. Lady Bird just made plans to spend Thanksgiving with her new boyfriend. And in this scene, Marion is taking her to the thrift store to pick out a new dress to wear at his fancy family's house.
Did Danny say whether his grandmother has a formal Thanksgiving?
I don't know. There are a lot of kids, but she lives in the Fab 40s.
Oh, well, your dad and I went to a dinner party once in that neighborhood. The CEO of ISC, that was pretty formal. You're not going to a funeral?
Well, I don't know. What says rich people Thanksgiving?
I just think it's such a shame that you're spending your last Thanksgiving with a family you've never met instead of us. But I don't know. I guess you want it that way. Are you tired?
No.
Hey, Marion.
Hey, Joyce. Hey, how's the baby?
He's crawling.
No, I want to see a picture at checkout.
Okay.
So if you're tired, we can sit down.
I'm not tired.
Oh, okay. I just couldn't tell because you were dragging your feet. Well, I just couldn't tell.
Why didn't you just say pick up your feet?
I didn't know if you were tired.
You were being passive aggressive.
No, I wasn't.
You are so infuriating.
Please stop yelling.
I'm not yelling. Oh, it's perfect.
Do you love it?
Oh, man. Lori Metcalf, welcome to Bullseye. It's great to have you on the show.
Thank you, Jesse.
I have to say that when I watched Lady Bird, and I watch it really knowing nothing about it. I watched it mm-hmm. before it came out because we were going to have Greta Gerwig on the show. Mm-hmm. And I had more, like, intense, upsetting high school flashbacks of the relationship between my wife and her mom, which was a wonderful relationship and is a wonderful relationship, and my mother-in-law is the best. But it's those weird emotional dynamics are so tense and so continuous.
Yes. The mother-daughter, well, it's a beautiful and so complex mother-daughter relationship that Greta captured on the page, you know, as the writer, the screenwriter, and then and also in the direction that she so brilliantly did. And it's how the intensity can just spin out on a dime. And then everything falls away and is forgotten because you're on to the next lovely moment between the mom and the daughter. She just really did that well.
Did living with the script change the way that you thought about your relationship with your own kids or your relationship with your mom?
It really did. I was looking at it from the mother's point of view, obviously. And when I first read the screenplay, I knew instantly, you know, how the headbutting scenes would go because I was actually living that at the time with a teenager in the house. And so those were really easy to connect to. But I was also really thankful that Greta peppered in the moments of heart between the mom and daughter and where they are on the same page. They're comforting each other or they're reminiscing about or they're having a very nice shared experience together because we're just seeing them during this dysfunctional moment in their lives. It's never always been this way and it won't stay this way. But what I was really shocked when I sat in an audience for the first time and listened to it, watched it, hearing some of the language come out of my character's mouth because in playing it, I knew where that character was coming from, and it was from a place of heart, actually, of wanting to help, of wanting to, you know, kick this kid's ass and get her into gear and make her, you know, just sit up and start to appreciate things and, you know, everything that the mother wants for her daughter. But to hear it come out in such an aggressive way when I watched it was really startling to me and really did make me think of how I have phrased things to my own kids.
Was there anything that Greta Gerwig told you about what she wanted the character to be and what she wanted the film to be beyond what was on the page?
No, I think it was all on the page. It really, she had worked so carefully on the script, so meticulously, that by the time we got to the set, there was never that weird scramble that you can have sometimes where everybody looks at each other and says, well, this isn't working. Now what do we do? Because we have to get this shot in, you know, the next 3 hours. We were all on the same page. We had a couple of days of rehearsal, not days, a few meetings where Greta would spend with either as many of us together as could in whatever city that we were in, or Saoirse and I got to spend a couple of days with her in her apartment or at her office in LA right before we were about to shoot, just to make sure we were on the same page, just to make sure that if we were going to have another antagonistic scene together, that we didn't want to make it the same as the one before it, because there's a lot of that throughout the film with the mother and the daughter. And so we wanted to parse out, you know, who was actually triggering it this time around, who was being passive aggressive, who was interpreting whatever something benignly said, you know, in an antagonistic way, you know, mix it up like that. So all of the battles weren't the same.
There is kind of an amazing blend of textures in those relationships as I see them. I mean, it's something that I have with my mom, but it don't feel like it's the same, which is there's a lot of just kind of like there's a lot of kind of poking and falling back. And I don't think it was a relationship that I had seen before in a film. That kind of there's a lot of bruise pressing, but not a lot of dressing down, you know? Oh, I'm getting chills just thinking about it.
Chilling, yes. Because it's so real. It's, you know, she just, maybe we haven't seen it, but it certainly it exists in probably every family that I know, and she's really captured it.
Let's hear another scene from Lady Bird. My guest is Laurie Metcalf. So in this scene, the whole family, including the brother and his girlfriend, are all sitting down at breakfast. And Marion, which is Laurie's character, and Lady Bird are arguing over who should make the eggs. And then the vegan girlfriend, who is maybe like 19 or 20, she's kind of saying that eggs are bad for the environment. And the dad is there and he's reading the newspaper and not really paying attention. And they're all sitting together and they're talking to each other, but no one is actually breaking through to anyone else.
Why can't I just make the eggs?
Because you take too long, you make a big mess, and I have to clean the whole thing up.
Eggs aren't good for the environment anyways.
What?
You heard her.
Eat quickly, please.
Look at all these pictures. Every newspaper looks like USA Today.
Shelly and I are trying to be vegan. Hence the soy milk.
You wear leather jackets.
But they're vintage, so they don't support the industry.
They aren't done. There's white stuff.
You know how much you love Brambles? Pigs are smarter than him, even.
I never thought Brambles was a genius, okay? Mom, the eggs are not done.
Fine, make your own eggs.
I wanted to. You won't let me.
Your sister doesn't like me.
I'm hungry.
She does.
There's a chance. Maybe. Going to bed.
I have a buddy who has actually guest hosted this show before, a comedian named Guy Branum. And he is a huge gay genius from outside of Sacramento. And he's from what you might call rural Sacramento. You know, you don't have to go that far outside of Sacramento before you're in America's breadbasket. Right. And I think Guy connected more deeply to the Sacramento-ness of this film than anyone else on this planet. Mm-hmm. And as I was reading about your early life, I wondered if, as a person from Southern Illinois, whether you related to that Sacramento-ness, that feeling of living in almost an outpost.
Yeah, I did. I think Greta described Sacramento as the Midwest of California. So I felt perfectly at home, whether we were, you know, shooting scenes within the house, which was actually set in L.A., or during the last 2 weeks when we got to go up. And it was my first time seeing Sacramento, and things just sort of clicked. I mean, it seemed like a small town, and you couldn't – I saw the beauty in it, but I could see how easily it would be passed over by – especially by a teenager having grown up there. And the architecture even made sense to me. I don't know. It's a love letter from Greta to Sacramento, and it made me really, really appreciate the place.
If you were telling someone what was special about where you grew up in the way that she did with Sacramento, what do you think? What do you think someone wouldn't understand about what it's like to be from Southern Illinois?
I like the flatness of it. And I love, of course, it was, you know, very long time ago. So there was a naivety that I liked growing up where I did. Small town again. I think at that point the town was under 10,000 maybe. It was very clear to me. Southern Illinois just has a clearness, I guess. I just understand, you know, the people are very practical and upfront about things. There's not a lot of role playing going on or anything. You understand somebody pretty quickly. They just are what you see them as, you know.
It really is something, the extent to which the kind of cultural experience of growing up in a particular place doesn't translate perfectly when you are somewhere else. And you have to really, like, not just learn how to understand how people from other places are in the world, but also just understand that other people from other places in the world are different. Like, it's a sort of a two-step thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you have that? Did you have that experience? Like when?
Well, my first experience was when I did go to college, and I didn't go as far as Lady Bird. I didn't go across country. I stayed within Illinois, so I went about a few hundred miles away to central Illinois, from southern to central, which was a huge move for me, and I started hearing a very, very particular, but to me, foreign accent, really, really strange. Had no idea what it was, and it finally dawned on me that these were kids coming down from Chicago. It was like a different land. And it took me a long time to piece it together, to figure it out.
You could eventually, you learned that they were the ones holding a jar of sport peppers. Signature Chicago condiment.
Yeah, and little did I know that I would move there and form a theater company and spend the next 20 years, you know.
I feel like I get the impression that when you were a teenager and even when you were in college, you did not have a plan.
No plan. No. I worked up the nerve to audition for a play while I was in high school, and that's as far as it went. You know, I was not trying to kid myself that I would ever be able to make a living at being an actor, because nobody did. Nobody that I knew, nobody within, you know, thousands of miles of me.
When you were in college and you were majoring in, I believe initially, German, which
is pointless.
Is that a romance language? It's definitely a very romantic college major.
I don't, you know, I had taken it in high school, and I really loved the language. But what I thought that I was going to do with it, I mean, this is a typical 17-year-old's thinking, you know, like there's no way I'm going to be an actor, so I won't pursue that. But I will pursue the study of German. Thinking what? Oh, I'll be a translator somewhere. You know, where? There was no connecting of the dots anywhere. So, but I did know that I liked the language. And in hindsight, I think I just like language, and I like writing. I like to be a literal interpreter. So I was going after being an interpreter in the wrong way. So acting kind of solved that for me. I'm able to be an interpreter, not only of language, but of body language. And that to me is really fascinating.
Among the folks who ended up being founding members of the Steppenwolf Theater, who were your friends in college, who do you remember glomming onto first? Or glomming onto you? I don't mean to be presumptuous.
Well, we glommed on all together as some icky group, frankly. I mean, it was very incestuous. So we switched partners all the time. We were very secluded and insular. We knew nobody else, especially when we formed our little tight weirdo company. But we were all taken with each other. We just had a shared sense of humor, and we had a shared passion for theater. And what we all wanted to do more than anything was either make each other laugh in a role or make each other cry in a part. You know, so we challenged each other in that sense, and we were very lucky that we had a lot of talented people. It was just a fluke, and we also had a lot of talented directors that came out of it, because we were all just actors. Nobody wanted to direct. That was like the dud job if you had to direct a play, because that meant that, you know, you didn't get to be on stage with the rest of the gang.
What did John Malkovich wear when he was 20?
I don't know how to describe it. he would wear a suit, that's for sure, which was unheard of. So a suit and a tie and maybe even a vest.
I mean, this is like 1974 or 5
yeah,
or something,
yeah,
right?
Yes. Ridiculous. And then paired with giant, giant platform shoes. Or for a while, I think he went through one of those phases where he wore those little Chinese slippers. They're just black and they have a little strap that goes across.
Like a Bruce Lee, Mary Jane situation?
Yes, yes. He was the most fashion forward of all of us. I mean, the rest of us, and I still do, are in jeans and a flannel shirt every day. That's what I'm wearing right now, you know.
Was it as intense as the reputation suggests it was? And not just intense almost to the point of, like, to the whatever is just sort of violence, I think, is
yeah.
pretty much what the reputation of that
yeah.
theater it was.
Yes, it was. Yes, we would do things on stage. If we were supposed to beat each other up on stage, then we beat each other up. You know, we didn't see any other way except to do it that way. And it was intense in the sense that we were 20 years old and everything is intense. You know, and so you can have a company meeting and somebody's going to start screaming and run out into the street, you know, and want to be begged to come back. Come back, please, please, we didn't mean it. You know, everything was heightened. And again, we had, you know, people were having relationships within there, and that comes with its own baggage, you know, like maybe one couple is just broken up and they're not speaking or not on good terms and everybody's tiptoeing around them, you know. It was a melting pot of adolescent angst and excitement and I don't know that I would want to revisit that again, but in the moment, it was always exciting.
I was shocked to read that literally when you were picking what play to do, you'd go to the library.
Yeah.
To the play section.
Yeah. So what year? That would have been like 78 or 9 or something like that. So we would go to the library and check out best plays of 1977 and just try and find something that at least had a role for a couple of us and then the others could fill in.
Lori, I don't know if it was a good plan. It's a better plan than checking out worst plays of 1977.
True. True. Yeah. But we had no resources, you know, and nobody could write. So we knew we were chomping at the bit to get great parts and wanted to act. And we needed that vehicle, you know, so we would just any play was good enough. You know, we would just go at it 150%.
Even more from Lori Metcalf still to come. We haven't even talked about Roseanne yet. Plus, Kristen Anderson Lopez and Robert Lopez, Oscar-winning songwriters. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR. Support for Bullseye and the following message comes from Independent Lens, an Emmy Award-winning documentary series featuring films from across the country that remind us we're all neighbors. See their unique stories Monday nights at 10, 9 Central on PBS and streaming free on IndependentLens.org. Presented by ITVS.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is the actress Lori Metcalf. She's nominated for the Best Supporting Actress Oscar for her role in the movie Lady Bird. You had a part that transformed your acting career in a play called Balm in Gilead,
mm-hmm.
Which by the time you were doing it in Steppenwolf was already a revival. And then you, as a group, brought it to Broadway.
Mm-hmm. Off-Broadway.
Off-Broadway. And this is in the early 1980s, I guess.
Yeah.
And I read Frank Rich's review from the New York Times of that show. I have hardly ever read a more effusive review about an acting performance than the paragraph that he dedicated to you. I think he said that it will surely be one of the highlights of the year in theater or something like that.
Well, it was a really special play, and it was a really special time to be in New York. It's the first time I'd ever gone to New York, went there as a group. We knew the play worked because we had done it in Chicago, and it was working really well. And it was a very theatrical play, which was different for the time. And John Malkovich directed it, and he threw in music by Tom Waits and Bruce Springsteen and Ricky Lee Jones. And it took off. And those three people came to see the play in a little 125-seat house. It was really a heady time to be doing theater. But it came with this terrific part that I got to play, which had a long monologue in the middle of it, which was so beautifully written that it was just a real surprise to the audience. And to this day, about every 2 or 3 months, somebody stops me somewhere and says that they saw that play and that it has stayed with them. They can quote lines from it. They remember it vividly because I think it was so theatrical. It had 30 people in the cast, and sometimes people would freeze and a big spotlight would come down on one person and the music would swell. It was very, very different. And people remember the pictures that it formed, and they remember that monologue too.
That monologue, when you say it was a big monologue, that was like a 10 or 20 minute monologue, like almost a one act play in and of itself. I don't have any recordings from 1984, but I do have a recording from a few years ago at Lanford Wilson's memorial service, where you performed just a little bit of one of the monologues and talked about what the work and what he meant to you. Your character, Darlene, is a somewhat naive prostitute, and you're in this diner that you described that's full of various types of people who are on the outs, you know, runaways and junkies and all this kind of stuff. And this character is very has an odd sort of optimism.
Yeah.
In her foolishness. So I want to take a listen to just a little bit of my guest, Laurie Metcalf, performing Darlene from Lanford Wilson's play, Balm in Gilead.
This guy I used to go with when I first got a room of my own up on Armitage Street. Do you know that part of Chicago? Most of the streets either run east-west or up and down. It's pretty much one or the other. But some of them kind of cut across all the rest of them, like Amity Street does. A lot of the nicer ones do. Fullerton does. And they're wider with big trees and all. And there are all of these lovely old apartment buildings, very well taken care of, with the little lawns out front, little flower boxes in the windows and all, you know what I mean? And the rents, compared to what they charge you with here, the rents are practically nothing. Even in this neighborhood. So my apartment was two flights up right in the front. It was so cute, you would have loved it. They had it all done over when I first moved in. They had three rooms. And just this lovely big living room looked right out onto Armitage Street, and a cute little kitchen. And the bedroom looked out onto a garden. And across from the garden, there was Rand Park. Or South Park. I never really heard.
Everything she's saying is wrong. She's getting all the names of things wrong. And this was so wonderfully written that it was a character that, you know, I think somebody said you would kill yourself if you were caught on a long bus ride with this person. and she's just beyond stupid. And it goes from being a character that you would totally write off to someone who is very, very deeply moving at the end. And that was the brilliance of the writing, and that's why I think that people, the monologue stood out so well, because it was just something that you hadn't seen or you didn't expect it. You thought, okay, I know this person right off the bat, and then 15 minutes later, you're sobbing because of what she's saying.
You were not an accomplished screen actor when you were cast on Roseanne.
No, I'd never done anything. No, I take that back. I had done one movie.
Yeah, you were in Desperately Seeking Susan.
Mm-hmm.
Did you, like, move to Los Angeles and start auditioning for sitcoms, or?
Well, I was in Chicago doing plays back to back to back, and then went to New York to do Balm and Gilead, and off of that, I got cast in Desperately Seeking Susan, and I thought, okay, well, that was just a one-time only film shot or whatever. Then I went back to Chicago, more plays. And then I thought, you know what, maybe I'll... Gary Sinise had moved out to L.A. and he was having some good luck getting some TV work, I think. And I thought, maybe I'll go out to L.A. I'll give it 2 weeks. I'll stay on somebody's couch and see if I can get a movie. And then it just so happened that the same casting directors who cast Desperately Seeking Susan were casting Roseanne, and they were in L.A., and I happened to be there. I mean, literally in the right place at the right time. And I went in and read for them. They didn't even have the sides written for the sister. So I read Roseanne's sides, and I got the part. And then I thought, oh, I don't know, though, a TV role. What if I end up getting typecast? And they're like, you know what? You'd be an idiot to pass on this. So I took it, and luckily it was just one of the best written sitcoms ever.
I mean, one of the best sitcoms ever. I know that you can't compliment the acting because you were one of the actors, but all around one of the greatest television shows ever made. Yeah, I mean, how about this? Let's hear a scene from Roseanne. And my guest is Laurie Metcalf. And if you don't remember well Roseanne, well, great news. You get to watch Roseanne for the first time. But Laurie played Jackie, who was Roseanne's sister. Roseanne was the lead in the show alongside John Goodman. And so in this clip from the show, Jackie and Roseanne are finding out that their dad passed away. And Roseanne is sitting at, I think it's a kitchen table. And Jackie is talking on one of those phones that hangs on the wall. And Roseanne has made her call a relative to break the news that their dad has died.
Annie Barbara, it's Jackie. Jackie. I'm fine. Fine. I'm fine. I have some bad news. Dad is not with us anymore. I said, Dad has passed away. He's passed away. Dad is gone. Dad's dead. He's dead. No, dead.
I feel
you know who wrote that?
Who's that?
Norm MacDonald.
Oh, well, there
you go. He wrote that little bit. Yeah. He's got a wicked sense of humor. You know, he was one of the writers on this Roseanne reboot he came in to write.
Yeah, he was sitting there in a room with my buddy Morgan Murphy, who's a brilliant TV writer.
Morgan.
But I was like, she's sitting in there with Norm MacDonald in a windowless writer's office. how did it feel to return to that so many years
later?
It
was surreal. It was sort of unsettling because so much time had passed, and yet it felt like no time had passed at all. And we'd not been in it all of us in a room together for 20 years. And they recreated the set perfectly. I mean, everything was exactly the same. And which they had to do from scratch.
Did you have to think when the prospect of this came up? Is this something that I want?
No, I didn't even think about it. No, I had always hoped for at least a reunion show when it ended 20 years ago. But I'd given up hope because so much time had passed. And then when Sarah Gilbert called and said, would you like to revisit Roseanne? Everybody immediately said yes. And it was a great vibe on the set. Everybody wanted to be there. I think the writers wrote really true to the characters. We did 9 episodes and comes on in late March. And I think it's a real throwback to what the show was like, you know, like just sort of small stories, family oriented, but, you know, set in 2018.
Lori Metcalf, you're the greatest. Thank you very much for coming on Bullseye and talking to me. What an honor to get to have you on the show. I was so
Thanks,
happy
Jesse.
To get to meet you.
Thank you.
Lori Metcalf, ladies and gentlemen. She's up for Best Actress in a Supporting Role at the Academy Awards. Those are happening March 4th. You can catch them on television. If you live in New York, she'll be performing on stage in the Edward Albee play Three Tall Women. That opens March 29th. And if you haven't seen it yet, Lady Bird is still playing in select theaters, and man, it sure is great. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My next guests are a dynamite songwriting duo, Kristen Anderson Lopez and Robert Lopez. Together, they wrote Remember Me from the hit Disney Pixar film Coco. Before that, Kristen and Robert wrote the songs for Disney's Frozen, including the Academy Award-winning and chart-topping Let It Go. Robert also wrote music for The Book of Mormon, Avenue Q, Scrubs, and more. He's actually one of only 12 people to win an Emmy, a Grammy, an Oscar, and a Tony. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, an EGOT right here on Bullseye. If you haven't seen Coco yet, first of all, you should see Coco. It's super great. Secondly, the story revolves around Miguel, a young boy living in a small town in Mexico. Miguel is an aspiring musician, even though his family has long since banned music for reasons that are a little complicated to explain here. And on the Day of the Dead, when families all over the country remember their lost loved ones, it all comes to a boiling point. He runs away from home, and by a stroke of magic, he meets his ancestors in the land of the dead. It's a fantastic premise told with rich, striking colors. Is Coco a kid's movie about death? Sort of, yes. But it's also about the legacies we leave behind and the way that families change. Remember Me, the song that Kristen and Robert wrote, really drives that point home. Let's listen to one of the 2 versions of the song that are in the film. And that's one of the amazing things about the song. In the movie, without giving away any spoilers, there are 2 very different versions with very different meanings. This one is a love song from a parent to a child, a kind of lullaby.
Remember me, though I have to say goodbye. Remember me, don't let it make you cry. For even if I'm far away, I hold you in my heart. I sing a secret song to you each night we are apart. Remember me, though I have to travel far. Remember me, each time you hear a sad guitar. Know that I'm with you the only way that I can be. Until you're in my arms again.
Kristen Anderson Lopez and Bobby Lopez, welcome to Bullseye. I'm so happy to have you on the show, or back on the show as well.
Thank you so much for having us. We were so excited when we saw this on our itinerary.
I am worried for you because you guys have a show opening on Broadway, which is 3,000 miles from where we're sitting right now in like 2.5 weeks.
Uh-huh.
Are you like frantically rewriting songs right now or are you locked in?
Well, let's see. In the car on the way here, we were mixing or like working on the final mix for the tracks that we're releasing on Frozen Fridays starting February 23rd. We may have rewritten some of the opening number the night before we flew out here for the Oscar luncheon. We may...
There's just no telling whether we did or not.
There's a lot. It's a lot. There's a lot.
I mean, you have been at this level of intensity and efficiency now for something like 5 or 7 years. Like, I don't think I've ever corresponded with you, which I do once or twice a year, without you being in crunch time to deliver a giant project.
Yeah, see, that's a sad, sad truth.
What do your children think of, and the two of you are married and have children, what do your children think of your lives when mom and dad are in crunch time getting a musical on stage?
Well, this one is different than any other, 'cause we have never actually had to both birth a Broadway musical, which is basically like taking med school boards for 5 to 7 weeks. So this one, we've armored up. We've prepared them since October. We've been talking about February and March, like winter is coming. and we have my sister and her writing partner coming to live at our house starting February 15th. So if we need to see a preview and then spend all night writing the show and then spend the whole next day putting it in, rewriting the show and spend the whole next day putting in the rewrite. We can. You need to have that flexibility. Do you have anything to add to that? Because I'm talking a lot.
Well, it's funny because, they've always been mildly annoyed at our trips to go to awards shows and stuff like that. And this time, they've been incredibly supportive. And I think it has something to do with the fact that we're bringing them as our dates to the Oscars. They were like, when are nominations announced?
Yeah, actually, clocking it. They were like, nominations 7 days from now. And we actually did just go buy their dresses on Saturday afternoon at Saks Fifth Avenue. And they're very excited. So they have skin in the game on this Oscars. But we've been preparing them for, that's just going to be a wonderful time for us to, in the middle of previews for Frozen, to just leave New York and just be together. And yes, we do have to walk a red carpet and wear some fancy clothes, but it will be 24 hours
of quality time.
Of quality time.
That's a very ambitious way to look at this trip. It sounds like it will be 24 hours of trying to get children and their luggage onto airplanes and that kind of thing.
Oh, they're good. They're very good travelers, I have to say. They know the rolling bag. They're really good with that.
The flight attendants always give us compliments on them.
They like to sit together and be really, really polite. And then the flight attendants give them free stuff. They have worked it out where if we are model children and we pretend like we really love each other and we're very polite, that we will get so much sugar from those flight attendants. It's a system.
More Bullseye after a quick break. Still to come, Bobby and Kristen tell me how to sneak grown-up jokes into kids' movies. It's harder than you'd think. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR. Support for Bullseye and the following message come from Starbucks. For the past 43 years, Starbucks has served their bold signature espresso. But for the first time ever, they're introducing a second espresso, Starbucks Blonde Espresso. It's smooth and subtly sweet. So whatever your drink is, from a flat white to an iced Americano, try it with Starbucks Blonde Espresso. And as always, you can order ahead on your Starbucks app. Thanks for listening to Bullseye. Help us out by telling us what you like and how we could improve by completing a short anonymous survey at npr.org/podcast survey. It takes just a few minutes, and you'll do all of us at Bullseye a huge favor by filling it out. That's npr.org/podcast survey. Thanks. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guests, Kristen Anderson Lopez and Robert Lopez, wrote the song Remember Me for Disney's Coco. It's up for Best Original Song at this year's Academy Awards. Kristen, I get the impression that you fell in love with Bobby like when you laid eyes on him.
Yeah, maybe you heard the story. I did. I totally did.
She did.
He walked in the door. And I was just out of like a 6-year relationship, and I'm definitely having that moment of like, what's next for me? And he walked in. I was like, that's my husband. I hope he's not too young. I hope he's not gay.
Because I was coming in to play. Because
he was coming
songs.
In to play a song and play a female puppet. Because he was presenting the first 2 songs he had written for Avenue Q, but there was just this very electrical thing. It turns out
she was right.
Turns out he was my husband. He's not gay, and he's a little younger.
I know about the incredible power of having graduated from an arts high school where I did theater and met my wife. I know how much juice it carries to be heterosexual in that environment. It's a real thrill. It's like something I would never ask for another partner. I'm thrilled to be married. Once in a while, I do think, remember how fun it was when you were the only straight guy around?
Well, in the case of the BMI workshop, that was the one place where it was opposite because it was a writing workshop. So, you know, if girls are socialized, if they love theater and everybody, all their parents and everyone around them says, you're an actress. That's why you have so many girls doing the plays and only like 2 guys, the 2 straight guys who get it all. BMI was the opposite. It was a bunch of straight
bunch of dudes,
men
yeah.
who can't really express themselves. So they've chosen to express it through music and rhyme and rhythm. And like 2 girls. It was the one time that I ever felt like the hot girl was at the BMI workshop for that year.
We got to change that, honey.
Well, it's all about picking your context. I'm trying to think where else I could go to be the hot girl.
I mean, the Oscars, right?
Oh, yeah. Margot Robbie like walked by and you at the Oscar luncheon yesterday, and it just
there's no one more beautiful at the Oscar luncheon than you.
Oh, you're so sweet. But Margot Robbie was. She's like not a real person.
My friend Kumail Nanjiani is very beautiful.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That guy. And they're another married couple that are both nominated.
Are you guys going to go on like an Oscar double date?
We should do that.
We were the only 2 people who, like, we were each other's dates. And when you get called up, you go on this platform, just like middle school graduation. And we were the only 2 collaborators that got to stand next to each other because we were married and sitting next to each other.
Do you feel, Bobby, when you are writing or performing musical theater, like you can sit comfortably in the kind of, I think the word I'm looking for is shamelessness that the medium requires?
I think there's a lot of joy for me, and I think for Kristen too, in inhabiting a more dramatic part of yourself and imagining what a character in a highly charged situation would be feeling. And we also, you know, we grew up loving this stuff, you know, we grew up wearing out these cast albums on, you know, Walkmans, on tapes and on record players. And you know, I think once that is the greatest hits of our brain. And we wanted to be like them.
What about you, Kristen? Are you naturally shameless?
I'm hopelessly shameless. I've been shameless. There's in terms of the embracing the large, vibrant, stylized world of musical theater. I mean, I just said that with very large gestures of my hands. I also think I think that we have a little too much shame about expressing our emotions in the current climate right now. I think we'd all be a lot healthier if when we needed to express something, we were able to say like, Perón, Perón, or you know, the sun will come out tomorrow. Like these are human emotions taken to an extreme, and I think extremes are good because that is what being alive is.
Well, I think it seems appropriate that we should listen now to one of your most iconic songs, which is "Let It Go" from Frozen, which is basically about that.
Snow glows white on the mountain tonight, not a footprint to be seen. A kingdom of isolation, and it looks like I'm the queen. The wind is howling like this swirling storm inside. Couldn't keep it in, heaven knows I tried. Let them in, don't let them see. Be the good girl you always have to be. Conceal, don't feel, don't let them know. Well, now they know. Let it go, let it go.
So something I like about that is I heard that Bobby, you actually came up with a kingdom of isolation and I'm its queen.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of a drag queenish line, isn't it?
Bobby has big emotions. For this mild-mannered guy, he actually, I do think every once in a while, I turn to him and I'm like, okay, Elsa, Bobby definitely has this like part of him that needs to stay perfect and small, and then something will just happen and this huge heart just sort of bursts out of him. And so I think that's where those early lines in the song come from.
Can you give me an example of that in your life?
Okay, here's a great example. The first time that we had to take my daughter to get her first shots, the newborn, our first daughter, we went to the doctor, and the doctor was like, okay, we're going to do it now. And I held the baby, and they gave the baby the shot, and, you know, she sort of went, and Bobby just started sobbing, absolutely, like, body-shaking sobbing. And that's just sort of who he is. Like, things will hit him, and it'll just be a sudden wave of emotion, whereas I'm very Lutheran and Scandinavian, and
takes a lot more than a shot to do that.
I have to, you know, it takes a lot to take me out of the needle, the safety of the needle, to make it go past the line, and that's always shocking too. But it's only happened like 3 times in my life.
I definitely like try and white knuckle that needle. I'm like, you're not going anywhere, needle. No, we're staying moderately upbeat.
Yes, yes. Like, it's fine. It's fine. I'm very resilient. I'm very resilient.
It seems like that song was part of the catalyst for transforming Frozen from a traditional fairy tale into, in some ways, kind of a deconstruction of the kind of fairy tale that Disney movies had been, especially for, you know, princess-driven, female-driven Disney stories. That there was something about, oh, maybe this character who was just going to be an evil queen type is actually a different thing. I presume that when you're writing a song from a character's perspective, there's no way to do it without empathizing with that character. But it seems like in writing that villain song, you know, in writing I'm the bad guy song, or in this case, the bad woman, you found points of empathy that were so deep that you, and so relatable to you, maybe you personally, Kristen, that like you couldn't simply let this be a villain.
Absolutely. I think once I started, we were taking a walk in Prospect Park and just talking about how do we deepen this song. And we started talking about the pressures that we feel. And I started unleashing it, as a wife does, on my husband, you know, all the pressure I was feeling at the time with small kids to be an incredible mom and cook the good food and be around, but also have a career and also be thin and also have a nice house. And just I started realizing, oh, my God, I am trying to be perfect in so many ways. No wonder I'm exhausted and dying to drink white wine at 3 p.m. in the afternoon. And I tapped into that part of myself, because what woman doesn't feel the need, like she has to be perfect, because the movies are telling us that we have to be.
What was it like for you to hear that in Bobby in such a concrete? I mean, those are themes that we hear as dad types, but I feel like it's really powerful to hear it from someone that you're in love with so explicitly.
You know, I have to admit that the movie itself. I mean, first of all, hearing it from Kristen. You know, you hear your wife say things like that a lot, and you assume, well, she has it tough and I have it tough. And I think it was a process of making this film and then seeing the film and seeing the response to it that really changed the lens through which I look at these issues and I think made me a lot more of a feminist than I even was before. Just how hard it is to get past all of the baked-in bias that we all just have from being born, you know, from being born and being raised in a culture, and it being time for the culture to change, and the culture of our family certainly changed. Before Frozen, it felt like I was the main writer and Kristen was helping, and now it feels like an equal partnership. I realize how much she has to say, how much she has to say that no one has heard in a big mainstream way. And, you know, I'm constantly in awe of how blind I was, you know, for so long.
Bobby's acting woke, which is good. It's good because
that whole time I thought you were looking at him lovingly. You were just waiting.
It's very hard to crack Kristen. She's not good at vulnerability.
No. I do see a huge transformation. I'm not kidding. In my husband, over the last couple years, as he really realized. He realized the lens. He was able to see the metal frame around the lens, because Frozen was, you know, here he was representing this thing that was widening the lens a bit, and he realized, oh my gosh, there really is a lens, and you know, when I noticed that, oh, almost everything we do, we have to get through a committee of men. And then it has to get through critics, which are mostly men of a certain age. And, you know, it's just pointing it out. Like, look, it's the numbers. Look at the numbers. Look at how many men are in this room and how many women are in this room. And he's just paying a little more attention to it. That's all changing. And that's a really exciting thing. But we're at the beginning of a change. And it's exciting for me.
I want to play a song that the two of you wrote together, but I'd like you to tell me a little bit about it first. It's called Wide, Wide World.
It's our first song.
How'd you find that?
Together.
It's from a smash hit show called Bear in the Big Blue House.
Oh, no.
On Playhouse Disney.
Oh, wow. Wow, you dug deep, Jesse Thorne.
I'm a professional man.
So I got this assignment because I was in with the music supervisor of the show long ago when we were in the BMI workshop. And Chris and I hadn't worked together at all. We were dating. We had just really started dating. And I tried a couple of takes on this song. My other collaborator, my main collaborator at the time, kind of begged out. And he was like, you take this one. And then I kind of got stuck because I was used to writing with someone by then. And I said, Kristen, why don't you come over? And the guy doesn't know you're writing it with me, but let's just write it, and then if he says he likes it, then we'll tell him that you worked on it too, and then we can split the money. And I think we had to write 5 different versions of this song. I remember they sent us back and back and back. And it was mostly about these 2 otters that loved clams, and everything that they said had to be about clams.
Had to be about clams. Yes, the clam jokes, because we did like 3 more songs for Bear in the Big Blue House, and there's just not much you can say about clams, but we've
hasn't
said
been
it all.
Said. Well, particularly for children.
Yes.
Let's take a listen to the smash hit song Wide Wide World from Bear in the Big Blue House by my guests Kristen Anderson Lopez and Bobby Lopez.
I think that it sounds great. The wide open road, the wind in your fur, the whole world to explore. The wide, wide world, it's open and free.
Those are the voices you dream of singing. Just spectacular.
But did you see the dueling philosophies at work there?
Yeah.
That was just a prototypical dueling philosophy song that we tend to really try to avoid from now on.
Bobby, you co-wrote 2 huge smash musicals, and both of them, Avenue Q and The Book of Mormon, were partly very sincere emotional journeys and partly kind of parodic and satirical. And I wonder if you ever worried that you were good enough to write a parody song, but were you good enough to write a quote-unquote real song?
I never worried about that because I only worried
good.
If I
Can
was...
you start worrying about that?
Thank you. I will add it to my worry list.
Now that you got the EGOT, I just want to take you down a few pegs.
I didn't get into songwriting to be funny. I never thought that that's where I would go. It was always one thing I wanted to do, to make a musical where you laugh from beginning to end that drew from great spoof material like Airplane or Spinal Tap or one of those great, the Simpsons musicals that show up in the episodes.
Let's hear a song from The Book of Mormon, which one of my guests, Bobby Lopez, co-wrote. This is the opening number. It's called Hello.
Hello. My name is Elder Price, and I would like to share with you the most amazing book. Hello, my name is Elder Grant. It's a book about America a long, long time ago. It has so many awesome parts, you simply won't believe how much this book can change your life. Hello, my name is Elder Green. I would like to share with you this book of Jesus Christ. Hello, my name is Elder Young. Hello. Did you know that Jesus lived here in the USA?
I think one of the cool things about the Book of Mormon is, it has much of the tone that the South Park guys have spent the last 20-some years working on, which is to say that it's pretty no holds barred, particularly for a Broadway musical, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
But I think the subject matter and the medium both lend themselves to a kind of generous open-heartedness that you don't get from Airplane or any of the, Spinal Tap or those other 10,000 jokes spoof things. Like the fact that these are young Mormon missionaries are the subjects of this, which is like the most emotionally vulnerable person in the world. It's a person who's, as in that opening number, just like showing up at someone's door because they believe in God.
As well-meaning as possible. Yeah.
Which is like a really beautiful and amazing thing, And so you can make an infinite, there's a wonderful song in the show called I Believe, which is like an inspirational tune about believing in, about having faith, but also the weird specifics of Mormon theology. And I don't mean to single out Mormon theology. All theology sounds weird if you don't believe in it.
That's the point.
Yeah. It all sounds crazy, but it's so important. Yeah. Like, how do we get through the big highs and the big lows if you don't believe in something impossible?
Something, no.
Yeah, and I don't think the whole thing works without that emotional generosity.
Oh,
to
yeah,
those characters.
They say that parody closes on Friday night on Broadway. You know, you need to have an emotional through line of your show. Otherwise, people are like, "Huh, fun," and then they don't go home and recommend it. You need to feel something, and that's what Broadway is all about.
You guys wrote some great jokes into the Frozen songs. And I feel like you guys have, like, a lot of the jokes that are slipped into Frozen are sort of rhyme scheme feints and, like, little things that I would recognize from, like, friends who improvise musicals where, you know, you take a sort of a prosaic word and then you surprise them with a weird word that rhymes with it and that kind of thing.
Yes, that tends to be what cracks us up. I don't know. We were just recalling Bobby did a version of Mystery Science Theater and was just vamping to something on screen. And he wrote this little song about smelting.
Yeah, they were ironworkers smelting.
We smelt. it's language can be really goofy, and it's fun to lean into that.
Do you have a story about how you got the joke, how can you have a ballroom without any balls?
Yeah, I was going to bring that one up.
Into a children's film?
I think it was
deeply sincere children's film.
The original line was, "We got the ballroom, just no balls," which I think is a better dual meaning line.
"We have the ballroom, just no balls." Yeah. That one did not get through. That one we had to soften it a little. But somehow, why have a ballroom with no balls?
It didn't move the needle. They were kind of like, yeah, that's great. That's a good line. They've had this ballroom and no balls.
One of the things we had to cut from that was, "I hope that I don't vomit in his face." They were like, "You can't say vomit. You just can't say vomit. It makes people vomit."
Yeah, there was a girl in the story room who you could tell every time we mentioned it or talked about it, she just got sicker and sicker. She was turning green at the end of the song, and so we were like, come on, it's funny. And then our daughter came up with the alt line.
Well, we were at the dentist when they were like, "No, it can't go through." And so I was trying to write it, and she was like, "Mommy, what are you doing?" And I was like, "Oh, I have to rewrite. I hope that I don't vomit in his face." And then she went, "I want to stuff some chocolate in my face." So she actually wrote that line, ironically, at the dentist, who was probably saying, don't eat chocolate. Yeah.
It's good to know that the line is somewhere in between vomit and am I nervous or just gassy, which is in the film.
Don't know if I'm elated or gassy is certainly, like, when we talk about writing from a very personal place.
Yes, the root chakra.
How did the song that you wrote for Coco, which is called "Remember Me," come to you? Like, what was the RFP, the request for proposals? Like, what was the remit? what was the thing they needed?
Leon Gritsch, he had seen Finding Nemo because he was a co-director on it, and I think he had always said that he wanted to do a piece where the music was the emotional turning point. And so very, very early on, he reached out to us, and we were working on, he knew he wanted to do something about memory and death and music and Dia de Muertos. And he asked us, "Can you write a song that can mean two completely different things depending on the singer and the arrangement?" And we kind of said, you know, "I hope so."
Yeah, it sounded like an amazing challenge, because how can a song, you know, be one thing and another at the same time? And we thought maybe we need, when he goes to the land of the dead, he has to discover a missing part of it. But then we realized, no, it'll be a lot cooler if we could write one song with the same chord progression, the same tune, the same lyrics. That means one, you know, completely shallow thing and
can be completely deep and emotional at the turning point of the movie. So, and I remember sort of almost tearing up when Lee was describing what he wanted. And we were kind of really hungry to write this song, especially because, you know, as we've said, we have two girls that our lives really center around, and we have to leave them so much to come out here. And we're constantly, you know, writing little songs to them and for them. And then luckily we were able to turn it into a mariachi version that that worked really rousingly.
That was more like, you know, good night, ladies, remember me.
Kristen Anderson Lopez and Bobby Lopez, Hollywood's premier songwriting power couple. Their song, Remember Me, is nominated for Best Original Song at this year's Academy Awards. It's featured in the Disney movie Coco, which is also up for Best Animated Feature. Let's take a listen to the blowout Vegas mariachi stage show version of the song.
Remember me. Have to say goodbye, remember me.
That's it for this week's Bullseye. Bullseye recorded at MaximumFun.org World Headquarters, overlooking MacArthur Park in beautiful Los Angeles, California, where just after Valentine's Day, we all stood at the window watching a slightly deflated-looking red heart-shaped balloon drifting haplessly over the lake. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer is Kevin Ferguson, with help from Christian Duenas and Casey O'Brien. Production fellows for MaximumFun.org are Jesus Ambrosio and Shayna Deloria. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. All our interstitial music is provided by Dan Wally. Our theme was recorded by the Go Team and provided to us by Memphis Industries Records. If you'd like to hear any of our past shows, all of them are free. You can find them on our website, MaximumFun.org, or wherever you listen to podcasts, or on YouTube by searching for Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. We've got some really good stuff up on YouTube right now. I did an outshot last week about Scarface that's doing great there. Quite a few real-life metal detectorists are upset about certain diction in the detectorists outshot from a few weeks ago. That is worth the visit. Also, the outshot will be back next week. We wanted to make some extra room for these two great interviews this week. I guess that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.